Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @RightStream and #RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
And good afternoon, listeners. It is a, well, kind of nice summer day here in Fairfax, Virginia. We are having just a really nice, nice summer. Not too hot, not too cold, not even too humid. And today on Military Monday, we're going to acknowledge something that is coming up really quick, and that is the centennial of World War I. Yes, folks, we've all lived long enough that the guns of August are about to go and kick off a 100th anniversary. And it goes without saying that for something like this, especially an event which can be commemorated, much like World War II this year for the 70th anniversary, World War I for the 100th anniversary can also be covered. And when I mean covered, I mean the world's media outlets are churning out a vast array of coverages, documentaries, books, magazines, annuals, albums, you name it. And I'm sure games and other things will be coming before long. Now, in the middle of all this, it's worth noting that most of this media is aimed at people who are in the 25 and above category demographic. In other words, it's designed to go and entertain and attract people like me, who are already attuned to television and other history products, especially books. But what about younger people? It's worth noting that World War I is a topic which does not have any longer any living memories. You can count the number of World War I veterans in the various countries around the world in the hundreds at best. Most of them are almost either 100 or older, and let's not kid ourselves, their memories are fading. But we have a lot of material on the personalities and the people from that conflict, and there are media outlets that are going and looking at that young adult and teenage audience because they're going to have to be introduced to this subject. World War I is a big deal. I mean, I don't think that just the name of it, World War I, tells you it was a big deal. It was a defining event in the history of the 20th century and for the entire world. So there are some publishers that are putting out products specifically designed for the teen and young adult market to go and inform them. One of those is our friends at Zenith Press, fine publishing house that does a variety of topics, including military history, aerospace, and such. We, of course, have had a number of their authors on the show. And today we're going to have another one. This one, though, is a little different because, unlike other authors, he's more than that. He's also an illustrator because the book that he's written called The Red Baron, which is a history of Richthofen's Flying Circus and the Air War in World War I, is not a conventional book. It is a graphic book. And to talk to us about this graphic book and what it actually tells about von Richthofen and the Air War in World War I is Wayne Van Sant. Wayne, are you there, sir?
I'm here.
Very good. Wayne, it's worth noting that you are no newbie to the business, not only of graphic books, but you've done your share of comic books and other graphic media.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that and your career in graphic media.
Okay. Well, I'll say that I was interested when I was a kid in the comics. I never was a superhero fan. I didn't know anybody that flew without a plane. But I was always interested in the war comics. I also like the classics illustrated and stuff like that. And I remember Classics Illustrated had a series that called The World Around Us, and they were historical, scientific, nature books, different things that told that taught the reader in a comic type comic book type format. And I always liked that. In the early 60s, I read Sam Glanzman's series Combat for Dell Comics, which were kind of documentary stories of the Second World War. And that was kind of the thing that stuck with me for years and years. And when I had the chance to do this kind of thing myself, that's what I was interested in. I began doing work for Marvel Comics, first in a comic, a black and white comic they did called Savage Tales. I did war stories, wrote and illustrated the war stories for them. And then I took over as the regular artist on the NOM, the comic they did about the Vietnam War. And I was only there about 5 years, I guess. And so it just kind of grew from there. And I had the opportunity to do a lot of nonfiction historical books on different aspects of military history and history in general, really. But that's kind of what got me started.
We'll talk about those books in a minute. I just want to ask for our listeners, where did you pick up the talents of historian, illustrator, and writer? I mean,
that's kind of, you know, it just seemed to come natural. I went to the Atlanta College of Art, and which I can give it a degree of credit, but my interest in history. My parents were from the World War II generation, so naturally all my friends were too, all the kids I went to school with. And I grew up hearing stories about World War II. Plus there was television, a lot of John Wayne movies and stuff like that, and, as I mentioned, comics, which were not very realistic, but still it got me interested. And as time went on, I wanted to read more and more about the historical fact and get deeper and deeper into it. And as I used to joke to people that my mind was full of a lot of useless information, but hey, it became useful later on because I have a pretty good grasp of history, especially in the 20th century, I believe.
Okay, now let's talk a little bit about the qualities of the books you're doing for Zenith Press right now. Now, you obviously said that in our talk the other day, you started with a book called Katusha. And what have the books that you've worked on of late for Zenith, physically and graphically and textually, how big are they? What are the parameters of them when you go to design one? And maybe most of all, what kind of graphic text integration would a reader see?
Well, I try to, you know, tell the story in pictures that I draw. And Katusha is a project that I'm still working on, by the way. I'll tell you more about that later. But so the first one I did for – well, I did several books for a small publisher several years ago. It was a company that did safety material for industry. And the owner of that company was a guy named Ethan Crash. And he was interested in history, and we decided to do a series of Civil War comic books, 32 pages, basically histories of different battles. But we started extending that. We did one about the Naval War, the Civil War, and it was about 100 pages. We were finding that we could do better if we had a little bit, you know, a product that had a little bit more information in it. And I also did one about the Korean War for him.
These are not traditional comic book size. They are actually trade paperback books.
The trade paperback books are 9x6, about 100 pages. They're about the Katusha books are longer, but my books for Zenith have been about 100 pages. The first one I did was on Normandy, on the Normandy campaign, which was something I'd always wanted to do. And what I'm doing is I'm telling the story by illustrating it. I can show things that you can't get out of photographs, especially true in World War I, where the photography was still pretty new, and you couldn't get a picture of a lot of movement. Say, for instance, if you want to describe an incident like an Oh, take Omaha Beach, for instance. You know, you cannot – the pictures of Omaha Beach were all taken after the fact. There were the few that the Hungarian photographer, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, who took about a dozen pictures on Omaha Beach, and the rest of his pictures were destroyed accidentally. But
yeah,
and they're very blurry and not very clear.
And but, you can obviously draw them from a perspective that no photographer was able to obtain and with a clarity that no photograph that survived has been able to go and show.
Right, and I think that I don't think I'm doing anything that's unrealistic. As I say, I don't do any super heroics. I just do human heroics, so to speak. And I can show the incidents of what happened. I try not to get too bloodily graphic. You sometimes have to, but I have a degree of taste that I don't want to cross, so to speak. But still, I show how terrible these events were. And I think more than anything else, I did a book on the bombing of Nazi Germany, and one reviewer remarked that my faces of my characters, you know, they may be getting ready to go on the mission, they're on the mission, and they're back from the mission, how different their faces were. And I've studied that quite a bit. I've studied some things, some of the details that you usually wouldn't think about, and I think it's paid off for me. Because, you know, the one thing that's got to be the one major thing in war is fear. And you learn to draw, you know, that on someone's face.
And talk a little bit about the faces you draw, because as I was going through the book this weekend, you have a very definite style that you use, especially when you're trying to make sure that when you see a picture of someone's face, if you've seen the photograph or you've seen the portrait,
right,
you say, oh, yeah, that's von Richthofen. Oh, yeah, that's Goering. Oh, yeah, that's Billy Ball, you know?
Well, I have always used a lot of faces and photographs of faces for my books. The real people, like von Richthofen, as many as I can find. And sometimes if I'm doing a character that may be a historical person or even as a fictional character, I love to use photographs from real people. I love to do that. I have been places, and you get some strange reactions sometimes from this, but I'll see somebody. I say, listen, I'm an illustrator. I'm working on a book. Would you mind if I set you down and took pictures of you? And some people just have such drawable faces, and some people don't. And I have boxes down in the basement full of photographs of different people I have used in different books. I've used myself. I've used close friends. I've used strangers. But that,
and you've
to me,
got a great face, by the way. I love the picture of you that you sent me.
Oh. Yeah, that was just an accidental photograph taken in Maidan Square in Kyiv, Ukraine, in, several years ago. But I've always liked that picture. I think it kind of fits me, I believe. But very frequently, I have used characters. I had a character in mind, and that was difficult, and I had to go out really and find a person that fit the character. It was somebody I was going to use a lot in a book.
And by the way, don't ever apologize for having a standard of taste and such. It's not like we have a lot of people who even know where there's a line regarding
right,
levels of violence and graphic injuries. I mean, let's face it. We live in a generation where the blood just spurts across
right,
our media.
Right.
In terms of the book The Red Baron, how did that project come to be? Was this something that you took to Zenith? Or did someone at Zenith ask you? What was the gestation of it, and how did it develop?
Well, it was funny. My editor, Eric Gilge, I had already started on a book about the Battle of the Bulge that I'd wanted to do and have it done before the 70th anniversary, which is this December. And I'd started on that, and he called me up. He said, listen, could you stop that and do a book about von Richthofen? And I said, well, yeah, I guess so. And he says, well, we got the World War One anniversary, the 100th anniversary coming up. And we all agree that it would be a great subject. And I had read about him. And, of course, I had read quite a bit about World War One. But I didn't know all that much. And they had several people there at Zenith. Hey, somebody at Zenith is going to be an expert on something or other. It's just, it seemed like it's that way. And they pointed me in the right direction, and I started reading up on it and realizing how little I knew. But I grew up seeing the comic book artist that George Evans. He used to do some real great World War One stories from the World War One, and he in aviation and all. And he was so good. I remembered those. I dug those out and found them, looked at them, and the planes are beautiful for one thing. But that's what got the project started. And I tell you one thing, one of the greatest resources is for like those planets is the Internet. Oh, my gosh. Google Images just blow you away how many pictures they have of any particular plane you can think of.
One last question about the process. Are you a drawing board guy who starts with a pencil sketch and then works from there, or
yes.
Are you a computer guy?
Well, I still draw on paper, and I will probably continue to. I think that's just it. Just me. In fact, in the case of the Red Baron, that entire book was done in pencil. I don't ink anymore. I've never been that great of an inker. I've never cared for my inking ability. But I found with you can do a nice tight pencil drawing, and with Photoshop you can clean up your little errors here and there, and it will come out quite clean. But I color on the computer mostly. I do a little bit. I go back into the printed thing of the work in color and go back and use markers. I like that effect. It's funny. A lot of different illustrators develop their own style of doing something, whatever works for them. And that's pretty much what, you know, for me. Of course, I write it in the InDesign format, so I know where everything's going to be from the very early writing process.
So in other words, you're kind of a hybrid creator, because we really can't call you an author. We really can't call you just an illustrator. I used the term when I was putting the promotion up that you are the creator of this product.
Yeah, that's right.
That all said, as the creator, you use a hybrid. You start with pencil on an old style
mm-hmm.
drawing board, and then move it over to the computer and begin using Photoshop and
right.
InDesign mm-hmm. and Illustrator to go ahead and create the finished product, I'm guessing.
It has changed a lot. I did my first work with Marvel in 86, and, man, it has changed since then. And, of course, the 25 or so years before that, I mean, it has changed a whole lot. But the computer and the things you can do, there's no telling where that's going to go. I don't think in my lifetime I'm going to see a computer turning out the whole project. I hope not. But I'll tell you why.
Because, you know, having been a child of the era of great comics, great political cartoons, and, of course, now graphic books, there is still something to be said for craftsmanship. And it's disappearing in a lot of ways, although it is being preserved. Okay, so having now given our readers some sense of how the book is created and what the product looks like,
mm-hmm.
let's go and talk about the story in this
okay.
book. And the story, the big story, is the air war of World War
right.
One. The little mm-hmm. story is zooming in on arguably the most charismatic and well-known aviator of the era, and that being Madrid von Richthofen. So let's start with the Great War. And
okay.
let's talk a little bit to our listeners. What was the state of aviation in August 1914, and how fast did it evolve during World War One?
Well, When was the Wright brothers flight? It was
1903.
Okay, just 11 years that man first, you know, got off the ground in something other than a balloon, and it was something brand new. And I think when the war started, they didn't know how it was going to affect it that well. They already had planes for aviation, and I think I mentioned in the book that. It says in 19, a war between Italy and Turkey and Libya,
right.
In 1911, 1912, that an Italian plane dropped bombs on some Turkish troops at some oasis. So the idea, you know, what? Hey, you're going to throw something out of an airplane, it's going to add the power to it as it goes down. And in the beginning, they were just for observation. And that was with a heavy artillery coming really into its own during that time. Having observation over the battlefield was incredible. Of course, they didn't have radios. They had to make that report and come back or send signals or something like that. But
take photos with handheld.
Sure, take photos.
Cameras.
Absolutely. And but was when planes, you know, enemy planes started coming near each other, somebody would throw a wrench at the other guy. And you got a phone there or something?
Don't worry, that's my fax machine.
Okay. Go ahead.
At some point, somebody got the idea of pulling out a pistol or a shotgun and taking a pot shot at the guy next to it.
That's right. That's right. Hey, shotgun would be pretty effective, wouldn't it? But, and of course, machine guns were coming into their own. There had been machine guns before the war. Of course, there were Gatling guns and stuff like that. But they were really coming into their power with Vickers and the other manufacturers. And, of course, they mounted them. They usually would mount them. Well, most of the planes were flying in were observation planes, and you had a pilot and right behind him an observer. Or the pusher planes with the propeller was behind the pilot. The observer would be up in a little front seat. But mostly, to begin with, those were the ones that had the machine guns mounted and would fire at each other. But later on, when you had the faster planes, the pilot would be a pilot in the plane, and they would have a machine gun usually mounted on the top wing. Now that wasn't too bad. But the problem with a machine gun, machine guns of the period of almost any time, they can jam. And they also had to be reloaded. The British used a lot of the Lewis guns that had the round drum that you had to reload the gun after so many, you know, shots. I can't remember how many it held.
Yeah, and they had on a hinge mount you had to bring down.
Oh, sure.
Hop on the new one. And, oh, by the way, keep flying.
Right. You know, That has to be a scary thing because, you know, you're going to hit the stick or something while you're standing up in the seat and it's going to flip over and throw you out. There goes the plane without you, you know. So the best idea.
Of course, the natural preference, of course, was let's mount it on the cowling of the engine directly ahead of the pilot. And, oh, by the way, probably vastly improve the aiming and accuracy
certainly.
Of fire.
Well, the problem we had, of course, was shooting through the propeller. And I'm sure, I think it was the French that first put, like, some metal plates on the propeller. And so the bullets would bounce off that, hopefully. And sometimes it would bounce back at the pilot. But the thing they finally did, Fokkers did, was to, what did you call it? I got in here.
The interrupter gear. A series
yeah,
of
the
cams
synchronized mechanism. Yeah, and it would cause the machine gun, the blade would turn in, and it was geared with the propeller and with the machine gun, and it would keep the machine gun from firing as the blade was coming by. And I show in the book the diagram that I found and the instructions. Which, hey, listen, my technical ability on a lot of things, if it was me, they would probably still be throwing rocks at each other. I just don't think I could have come up with something like that. But a number of people would shoot their propellers off, and even that system, if it would get out of sync, it could still do that. And there were pilots, they believe, that later on did. But most of them had that were able to do that. Of course, the Germans had it, really had it first. And this is something I think I mentioned in the book, but, you know, since the nature of the Western Front was, it was primarily the Germans holding a line that was a little bit higher elevation than everybody else, the French and the British. And most of the war was on along that line. And the Germans very seldom flew out over British and French territory. They were usually pretty close to the line, and it was the British and the French that had to go deeper. So the advantage to the Germans was they didn't want to have that plane shot down over enemy territory so they could study that system, have that that machinery to study. So
most of the real advances that were done with aviation during that war, at least with fighter aircraft, then called pursuit aircraft, came from the Germans and guys like Tony Fokker, whose name still is applied to a company that builds regional transport aircraft here in Holland.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about the airplanes themselves, what they were made of, what the power plants were.
Well, of course, a lot of them were wood frame with canvas. The Germans would later use metal tubing for the structure, and it was all primarily canvas that had been doped to make it hard. Unfortunately, some of that material would make it more flammable. But they had the rudders and the elevators and all that stuff to make the plane turn. But one of the earliest successful German fighters was the Fokker Indecker, which was had one wing across. You know, was just wasn't a biplane. It was just a single wing.
A little monoplane
pilot. That's the word,
on top with his gun.
Right. And the funny thing about it, I tried to show this in one picture. I'm not sure it came across real good, but that thing, if it was between you and the sun, you could just about look right through it. It was just a real fragile looking thing. And in fact, I kept studying and looking at the pictures and all, and I realized that there were no flaps on the wings. Of course, you had the rudders and all on the tail, but the wings themselves, what controlled them was the pilot would turn the stick and the wires would twist the wings slightly, and that was
what the Wright brothers called wing warping.
Yeah. Now, that was so strange to me. I had never heard about anything like that, but that plane was very agile. And, of course, you know, the thing is, to fly these planes in the time that they lived, these people were either very brave or a little bit crazy. You had to be a daredevil. I don't know. I think, you know, they had not been flying very long. People had not been off the ground. They must have been extremely brave or just, well, they were the knights of the air. That's what, you know, we called them. But that's these planes, you know, they're very light. And some of them, if you you got, you know, some damage or something like that, you could land it pretty easily in a little field. But if you were up about 9,000 feet, where they frequently were, and you had damage, you went down like a rock. I mean,
and unfortunately, parachutes were not common in a lot of these.
No. In fact, later on, the only parachutes of most of the war were the ones in the observation balloons that the both sides put up. The guy in that would have a parachute on. He could jump out of that. In fact, it was the wire was connected to the basket, so when he jumped out, it would automatically open. Hopefully, you know. But the pilots really didn't have room for it. Several times later, they would have them, but it was still pretty rare. And I know it was Max Immelmann, I think, that they're not quite sure the reason he crashed, but the wings ripped off, and they think that maybe he may have accidentally shot his own propeller off, and the wings tore off. And he went down with that, you know, the engine right in front of him. He went down like a rock, you know. So
and these were not aircraft which could take a lot of damage. I mean, as you said, made of wood and canvas, doped with chemicals.
That's right.
And flying with castor oil and volatile
fuel.
Yes.
You know, that's right. You know, I first heard about the castor oil being. I met this lady one time who was. She worked at a museum at Walter Reed Army Hospital, and she had done her PhD in World War Medicine, and she was telling me. She was the one that told me about the engines, and those old planes used castor oil, and the fumes would give the pilots diarrhea, and they would carry bottles of. Blueberry juice with them, and they drink that, and that would help a little bit. But I thought, golly Moses, that's just, you know, that does take some of the glamour away from it.
Oh, yeah, and let's face it, you're flying around in basically a bomb that all it takes is one spark to light off, and
that's right.
Just flying around on your own before someone else comes up behind you and starts shooting you.
That's right.
All right, well, we're going to go and come back and talk a little more about the pilots, what
okay.
Wayne just called the Knights of the Air. But we have some network announcements to run, so give us a chance here. We'll be back in a couple minutes. This is Military Monday on the RightStream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for RightStream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. RightStream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. RightStream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to RightStream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the RightStream Radio Network.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorists, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, we wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. So we owe them a lot.
We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can. But we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives. And for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. What a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We we were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @RightStream and #RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
And we're back, listeners. This is Military Monday, and our guest today is Mr. Wayne Van Sant, the creator of the illustrated book, The Red Baron, which is about Manfred von Richthofen and his exploits in World War I. Wayne, are you with us still, sir?
I sure am.
Well, good. And let's talk a little bit about those young, daring young men and their flying machines that we somewhat euphemistically call the Knights of the Air, because that's certainly the image that they created. But the reality that they lived in day to day, week to week, month to month, and for a lucky few, year to year, they had a hard life, and their chances of dying were at least as high and probably higher than the men in the trenches they were fighting over, correct?
Yeah, you know, the infantry would look up and envy them, but that was true in World War II also, that, you know, you may fly 25 missions, but a lot of them never made 25 missions. But that's true, and you know, I think that in some ways the Knights of the Air thing is true, because before that the cavalry was the most glamorous of the services, and that because of cavalry kind of got put way back on the back burner during the war, and the air branch came forward. I think in many ways it's a more glamorous branch any way you look at it. But still, very, very dangerous.
And certainly in certain nations you saw aristocracy, particularly Germany and Austria, recruiting the cream of some of their first families in, von Richthofen being some of them.
Definitely.
On the other hand, you have the Royal Flying Corps, which was willing to take anybody, almost anybody crazy enough to pass physical and show some predilection to being able to fly.
Well, you know, and I think in many ways some of those guys elevated themselves because they did become national heroes in any country that had the fighter pilots. Those are the ones that became the heroes. And, you know, in World War II it was true too, you know. They did seem to have a more glamorous calling, but still very, very dangerous.
Well, okay. Yes, please.
One character that kind of fascinated me was the British pilot Albert Ball, who was a real good pilot, an odd kind of guy. But one thing about him, he felt a lot of guilt about what he was doing, because he knew he was killing a man by shooting that plane down. And although he was in combat, he was just a fireball, he would just go right into the fray of it. But he would write to his father and tell him how guilty he felt. So I didn't really see that in Von Richthofen, but or many of the others. But that was one that just kind of interested me, I believe.
And from the very start, when pursuit aircraft began to become common, there was no database of past experience on how do you take a three-dimensional flying plane with a machine gun, how do you maneuver it, how do you go and take advantage of its qualities to go and get on the tail of an enemy airplane and blast it out of the sky. We call those tactics, obviously, and they had to make them up themselves, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. Now, you had a handful of the early pilots, mostly the German pilots, who, now I know one of the main ones was Oswald, Bolchek. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right or not.
The guys at Top Gun who adore him call him Oswald Bolke. And, of course,
that sounds close enough. But he,
you're a Southern gentleman, and German is not required for Southern.
You'd be surprised how many of these things I study, and I find out the reality of how they're pronounced. I'm always wrong. But anyway, he came out with what he called, the Bolchek dicta. Let me find that right quick in here. Where he had eight things, like try to secure the upper hand before attacking. If possible, keep the sun behind you. Always continue with an attack. Once you begin it. Open fire only at close range, and then only when the opponent is squarely in your sights. And these are just little things that that made common sense, but somebody had to learn these. And Max Immelmann, who was also one of the early pilots that flew the old Fokker Endecker, he had what he called the Immelmann turn, and I don't think I can describe that over the phone. But the
turn, which can be done either vertically or from above, where you use the energy you have to go ahead and rapidly change altitude and pop onto the backside of an opponent.
That's right. Most of the planes that were shot down from the rear. Almost all of von Richthofen's were. He would, fly high, come out of the sun, and before that guy knew it, he'd be on his tail. And once he was on his tail real close like that, it was very difficult to get to shake him off. So that was the basic, and it had to have been pretty cold-blooded, to come behind somebody, because you could probably see them pretty good in those old planes. But it's worth pointing out
that both Max Bolke and Immelmann did not survive the war. The survival rate, even among the most successful fighter aces, was incredibly small.
In time, almost all of them died. Of course, there were a number of American, of course, like Rickenbacker, American, that survived. But they only went in at the very end of the war. And he was, spent a lot of time. He was sick, so he was grounded for a while. But that's true. Talking about this being a hunting thing. Von Richthofen was an incredible hunter. He loved to hunt more than anything. He, as a kid growing up, him and his brothers. He had two brothers, and they would go hunting elk and wild boar. And all through the war, that was an obsession with him, and he would go hunting. I wonder if there's any. I'm sure somebody has some of the heads and trophies he had from back then somewhere, because he had so many.
A lot of that was overtaken by the Russians at the end of World War II. But your point about him being a hunter is absolutely correct, and to this day. One of the most treasured skills of anybody who flies is the ability to judge how to lead an enemy aircraft and shoot so that the bullets they're not aimed at the airplane. They're aimed at the spot where the airplane will be when the bullets arrive.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And you see America's finest marksmen and fighter pilots all the way up through Vietnam and the present day. It's the guys who have gone and handled firearms and know how to lead.
Absolutely.
Even with guided missiles, who get the kills.
That's right. That's right. Well,
it's worth noting that those eight points from Oswald Bolke,
uh-huh.
I can tell you they're painted permanently on the wall out at Fallon, Nevada at Top Gun, as well as at Nellis Air Force Base at the Fighter Weapons School there.
I'm not surprised. I mean, some things don't change. Some things don't change at all. But one thing you can mention about von Richthofen, too, now, if he went out and shot a boar or an elk or something like that, he had the head, mounted and all that. Now, he couldn't do that with the planes, but he had those silver cups made.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he started having those silver cups made for every and I can't remember what all he put on them. I think it was the date, naturally, and the type of plane it was. But he began collecting those. And I understand that he's quit. Of course, he shot down 80 aircraft, but he quit at 60 because they could no longer import the silver because of the blockade and all that to make those cups. So he ended that at 60. He didn't want to make them out of a cheaper. And that's another thing.
Well, he did have a flair for trophies. In fact, the engine of Tony Hawker, who he had a legendary dogfight with, which he, of course, eventually won. He took the engine and made it into a chandelier, which was then sent home to the von Richthofen family mansion.
He also kept the Lewis gun from the plane, too.
Yeah.
He kept that. But
well, for all the dangers in the air, it's also worth noting that on the ground, as much for morale and rehabilitation purposes, because flying airplanes, as you've already pointed out, was a debilitating and uncomfortable experience at best. These men were well-fed, well-housed, shall we say, well-entertained in their off hours.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I've getting the location, looking here for the location of when he became a commander of his own squadron, was the headquarters was in a big chateau. I mean, they always – oh, here it is right here. Chateau de Bethune in Markerbelk, Belgium. But, they always had a great place to live. I mean, that was certainly better than the trenches. that's for sure.
And of course, got the best food available, got the prettiest girls available. I mean,
this is really
where the fighter pilot image that we still associate with Tom Cruise and Top Gun came from.
Well, though, Ron Richthofen, I think he was rather shy because there's one incident that I show in the book where he was flying back to get a medal or something, and he. Let's see, where did he fly into? He was flying into Cologne, okay. And he stopped at the landed there, and there was a band and a mayor there to welcome him, and all these young Fräuleins, and they all got around him, and he seemed really embarrassed. So I think he was a little bit shy of ladies. They always show him in the movies with some love interest, but. I don't believe there was one. I don't know. Maybe he just figured he would wait till after the war for that. I don't know. But he was a little shy, I think. But, hey, who knows?
He also was a man who fought a significant part of his career, the last part of his career, in great pain and with debilitating headaches.
Yeah, he was wounded. I think it was on the left side. He had a bullet creased him and creased the left hand side of his head. In fact, you could see the bone, and he spent quite a while in the hospital for that. In fact, it was a while. I think he finally said, "Well, listen, I'm going to fly." And he had headache problems after that. He also had an incident where he was flying an albatross at that time, and he the upper wing broke. It just one of the wooden struts broke, and it just it really scared the daylights out of him. And I think at that point in time that was you know, something that kind of the fear of the knowledge that he might not survive this thing may have touched him. And although he still did a lot of flying and, you know, shot down a whole lot more planes, but he was seeing, you know, the possibility of his own mortality, I believe.
And his final run, which was concurrent with the German Michael offensive in early 1918,
was just
an amazing string of kills, one after another. I mean, he was absolutely invincible, it seemed, right up until April when something rather horrible happened to him.
Yeah, for those that don't know about that, you know, the Russia was knocked out of the war. They, you know, had a revolution, overthrew the Tsar, and then, of course, the communists took over, and they did a peace treaty with Germany, and Germany was able to shift a lot of their troops, I forget how many, over to the Western Front to hopefully knock the British and French out of the war, and the Americans at that time. And the offensive was somewhat pretty successful. They pushed pretty far, but they didn't quite make it. And during that time, he shot down a whole bunch of planes. And the Sopwith Camel was a pretty standard aircraft at that time. Of course, they had the SE-5 Scouts, too. And the British were getting better planes all the time. And he was, that was something he was noticing. And he hadn't been flying the triplane that he's known for that long in this time. This is something else to mention. You know, his red plane, that is something else that's still in discussion. And, you know, they're not real sure. It may not have been all red like that. Some people say it was the upper wing and maybe the top of the lower wings and some along the body, and the rest of it was kind of a green or maybe even the lozenge pattern that they had. But I just decided, hey, when I do this book, I'm just going to color it red like the way you, because nobody knows for sure, you know. But
line at the end of the movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, when the myth becomes greater than the fact, print the myth.
Hey, that's it. That's it perfectly. I didn't think of that, but that's a great line for this. But yeah, he had not been flying that long. And I don't know. Until I started researching this, I was always in the impression that the biplane Fokker had come out beforehand. The D-7?
The D-7.
I believe. Yeah, I always thought it came out before the triplane, but it came after it, and it was really a better plane. I didn't realize that, but the triplane, the D-1, was a great plane. But they say because of those wings and that the vision for the pilot was not that good.
Situational awareness, great maneuverability, but not as fast as a camel and not
right.
as easy to see around.
And you can't – that wing right there in front of you like that must have been difficult to see around. So that was something I thought was kind of different. But
and on the last day of his life, he was doing what he always did, leading his men into a big fight, in this case
right.
against a squadron headed by one of the top British aces, Roy Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And he got on the tail of a young, inexperienced pilot and was chasing him and broke one of his own rules, which is, he got down low, close to the ground.
That's right.
And you tell the rest of the story.
Well, you know, Brown came behind him and did a burst of fire and then turned off. And then he was fired on. There were some Australian troops down below him, and he was first shot at by a Vickers machine gun that was mounted on a pinion, like for, you know, to fire at aircraft. And then another one came by another gunner who was a Lewis gunner who had the same kind of gun that was fixed up to fire an aircraft. You know, it wasn't the, you know, it was made to be in that position because of the ridge they were on. And then the plane landed itself. And Australian troops went up to it and found out he was who he was, and he was dead. And they've done some, you know, they you know, mapped where the bullet wounds were and where in his body he passed through and all that. And most people, although they gave Roy Brown credit for shooting him down, it's pretty much accepted that one of those infantrymen killed him. So, that's pretty much accepted.
Basically, it's most likely that Brown fire killed the Red Baron.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's pretty much accepted, I believe. Most people would agree with that, despite the movies.
And how was he treated? How were his remains treated by the British?
Oh, gosh.
He was buried
with the Australian troops with full honors and all the... You know, bases where the British pilots were. They all toasted them at the evening meal and all that. That was a different time. But you know, hey, listen, the first German pilots that were shot down in England in World War II were also treated that way, but not for very long.
Yeah, you get a little time on you, and you start not being quite so pleasant.
When they start bombing you day and night, you kind of, you know, decide that this guy, I'm not going to honor him anymore. I'm just going to kill him.
Yeah, we might take a lesson from our friends in Israel on that one.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Wayne,
if
you were going to go and, you know, summarize from your work on the Red Baron, what kind of legacy did von Richthofen and his peers on both sides leave behind for future aviators and us today?
Well, he's probably still the most famous fighter pilot that's ever lived. When you think about it, I mean, although there were pilots, you know, and the German pilots especially in World War II, but because they were Nazis, they weren't going to get the credit they probably deserved. But that, to me, some of the interesting things after I did this and researched, I was fascinated with the fact, well, what if he didn't? What if he hadn't been killed? Would he have supported the Nazis? Would he have been the head of the Luftwaffe in World War II? Would he have won the Battle of Britain? I mean, you know, there's
these
all
are
kinds
real
of
questions because he one
yeah.
of his brothers, I mean, or I can't remember whether it was a brother or a cousin,
it
actually
a cousin,
commanded one of the German
yeah.
air fleets during World
That's
War
right.
II. That's
right, Wolfram von Richthofen. Yeah, he commanded
yes.
Planes on the Russian front, and also. But he also planned the bombing of Guernica in the Spanish Civil War, which is a notorious, you know, event.
War crime.
And who knows? I mean, you know, you can't go back and change things, but you can't help but wonder about it either.
Especially since the officer who took over for him as the commander of Jagdflotte 26, the Richthofen
mm-hmm.
group, was a top German fighter ace by the name of Hermann Göring.
That's right. That's right.
Who wound up not only commanding the Luftwaffe, but being Deputy Reichsführer.
That's right. One of the top Nazis in World War II. Boy, he'd been too fat to get in those old planes, wouldn't he?
Probably
couldn't have got off the ground in one of those old Fokkers, you know. I don't know.
Well, we're coming to the end of the show
mm-hmm.
here, and I'd like to ask you, what are you working on now, and are there any more books, World War I, World War II, coming down the pike that are going to have your name on it?
Well, I would like to do my agent is working on getting the rights to do All Quiet on the Western Front. I'd love to. I always wanted to do that as a graphic.
As an illustrated book.
Right. Uh-huh. And,
well,
that would
be
also,
fantastic.
Yeah, and I would like to do one on the Americans in World War II, because there's so little about that. There really is. In fact, I'm already starting collecting some books for that. But another thing I'm working on is my Katusha series. We haven't said anything about that, but it's a really graphic, it's a historical novel about the Russian front in World War II, seen through the eyes of a Ukrainian, 16-year-old Ukrainian girl, who eventually becomes a tank commander in the Red Army. And this sounds far out, but it happened very often. There was a lot of women in the Red Army in World War II.
People don't understand, when the Russians mobilized, they had female fighter pilots, tank commanders,
right,
and especially snipers who, mm-hmm, you know, were heroes of the Soviet Union.
Snipers were great. They really were. Well, this is a series I'm really very close to my heart. I've done a lot of work on this. The first two books are out. You can get them on Amazon. But they are not only that, but they show that the Russian front of World War II was not a story of good guys versus bad guys. It was a very bloody affair where there were no good guys, and both sides were very vicious, and there were a lot of people caught in the middle. And I think particularly what we see on the news about Ukraine now, we see the results of some of that, you know, of what went on back then. But as I say, I'm hoping to have that third book out by this time next year anyway. And I got a Battle of the Bulge Cup book coming out from Zenith also. It'll be out in October, I believe.
Well, we might just have you on again and have you talk about it.
I'd be glad to be. I'd be glad.
Wayne, it's been just a pleasure to have you on. I hope we get to have you on again soon. And good luck. We'll be talking to you soon.
You betcha.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And with that, listeners, we come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. I want to thank everyone who took the time to listen. It was a fun show to do, as you can tell, because it let me talk both about books and history, which I love to do. And I hope you join us again next week on Military Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Take care. Be well.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. Never cry. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man, and now I'm out in the cold. What's the at all. There's a baby on the doorstep waiting away. There's a baby on the doorstep longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep who gives his life to take. A flare to a pawn shop, a flare to a pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dear.